thrown one 80 miles per hour. Knocked the best friend he had in the whole world on his butt. Laid him right out as if he'd run over him. Michael took a few steps in from the mound, knowing Manny was just lying there to make it more of a show. You okay? Manny's head came up first, big smile on his face.
I swear, I must have blacked out after the ball hit the glove, he said.
It was like you tried to throw one through everybody who's been busting your chops, Manny said.
Michael walked all the way into the plate, reached down with his left hand to help Manny up. I don't know what you're talking about, he said. That was my changeup.
Cute,
Manny said. From behind the screen, they heard a girl's voice say, Hey, hey, you guys. They turned around. Ellie. He couldn't even remember how many days it had been since they'd actually seen her. And now, here she was, as if they all had an appointment to meet behind the plate on this day. Now here she was saying, you guys, but looking right at Michael, who looked right back at her and knew in that moment how much he had missed her. Not that he was going to admit that to her, or to Manny. Michael would wonder later why he said what he said, why he would want to hurt her feelings, why he didn't let Manny do the talking, the way he always let Manny do the talking, why he would want to sound like a whole different person.
Hey, it's Miss Gonzalez, he said.
Come to slum it up with us ordinary guys?
Right away, Manny stepped in front of him, like he was cutting in on Michael in line, and said,
Hey, Ellie.
He only paused long enough to stick an elbow into Michael's side and say,
That was sweet,
before he started walking in Ellie's direction. She was wearing a Nike t-shirt and white jeans. Her sneakers with a pink Nike swoosh looked brand new. Michael saw she had brought her baseball glove with her.
You got time to play a little?
Manny said. But Ellie wasn't looking at Manny, or acting as if she'd even heard him. She was looking at Michael.
You know?
She said.
Yeah.
How?
They showed you on television, he said. The other night, with your sister. Manny said,
Okay then, so now everybody knows who everybody else is. We can stop wearing our name tags.
Manny made a motion like he was wiping sweat off his forehead.
Woo! There's a relief.
Ellie was still ignoring him.
You're mad that I didn't tell you myself.
Michael said,
Who, me? Why would I be mad about a little thing like you lying to me?
He still sounded like somebody else, and still didn't care. He felt like he was in some silly schoolyard fight, just with words, and wanted to beat her to the punch. Out of the side of his mouth, Manny said,
Aw, man, don't go there.
I didn't lie, Ellie said. I just didn't tell you everything. Do you tell everybody all your secrets?
What does that mean? Michael said.
What does what mean?
About secrets.
I was just saying...
It's different, Michael said.
You're his daughter. That's exactly why I didn't tell you.
Blah, 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 Manny said.
What? You didn't think we'd like you for yourself if we knew who you really were? They were still talking through the fence, Ellie making no move to walk around to where they were standing behind the plate. Like we're strangers all over again. Michael thought.
Something like that, Ellie said.
We liked you because we liked you,
Michael said. Another thing he'd wonder later, why he dug in like this, like he was digging a hole with those old spikes of his into the batter's box.
Not everybody does, she said.
We're not everybody,
Michael said.
Boy,
Manny said, still trying to lighten everything up.
You can say that again.
You don't understand how hard it is being his daughter, she said.
I wish that was the worst problem I had, Michael said.
That's not what I meant.
It was stupid to keep it from us, Michael said.
He knew he sounded like a jerk, that he didn't even sound like himself. Carlos liked to say that his little brother would walk around the block to avoid hurting someone's feelings. Now he was doing that to Ellie, on purpose.
So now I am stupid,
she said.
Anything else? I don't think my jerkball friend meant to call you stupid, Manny said. Did you, jerkball friend?
No, he's right, Ellie said. I think mostly I was stupid to come here today.
She didn't run away this time. She walked. Manny gave Michael about the meanest look he'd ever seen, then said,
Ellie, wait!
All she did was wave an arm, like, leave me alone. She kept walking across the basketball courts and up the hill, never once looking back. Chapter 19. No baseball. Now, no Ellie. The next thing to go wrong would be Uncle Timo with Mr. Gibbs tomorrow. Michael could see it now, every time he thought about it. Just because of the way things were going. Uncle Timo would slip up somehow, or Mr. Gibbs would trip him up with some question he already knew the answer to, like one of Carlos's know-it-all television lawyers. And all of a sudden, Uncle Timo would be calling the ACS man dude. And before the ACS man left the apartment, he would figure out that Poppy hadn't run out on Carlos and Michael. Even worse, that he had been dead for 3 whole months. And then, Michael squeezed his eyes shut as hard as he could, taking the same walk up the hill that Ellie had just taken. Michael just having told Manny that he didn't feel like practicing today. He didn't feel like doing anything. He just wanted to go home. When he got to 825 Girard, he went upstairs to the empty apartment, the quiet apartment. Never had it seemed quite this empty to Michael, quite this quiet. Never had he felt so alone.
Hello, little one, Mrs. C said after Michael knocked on her door. Come watch Oprah with me. I think she's going to give away more cars today.
Mrs. C had the same kind of recliner chair Poppy had, one that Michael sometimes had to help her out of if she'd been sitting too long. He wondered how she got up and out of it when he wasn't around to help her. Somehow, though, she managed the way she managed to get herself up the hill to Girard when she was on her way back from the Imperial Market, having worked out a system where she bought her supplies a little bit at a time. On days when she saw Michael in the back alley, throwing against his pitchback, she would take him with her to the Imperial.
It is a two-bag day, little one, she would say. Today you must be my assistant carrier. And maybe, just maybe, there will be a little candy in it for you when we get to the checkout.
Michael knew it wasn't maybe at all. She would always let him pick out whatever kind of candy bar he wanted. Nutrageous, usually. He watched her now, moving slowly across her own living room. The room as neat and clean as always, smelling, as always, of flowers. Even when Michael couldn't see new flowers anywhere. Lately, she was moving more slowly. He could see that her ankles, showing underneath her long summer dress, looked more thick and swollen than ever, as if they had been stung by bees. Michael worried sometimes that Mrs. C would be the next person he loved to leave him, even if he could not imagine his world without her in it.
We should write a letter to Oprah the way some of these people do, she said to Michael now. She is always trying to take care of strangers. Why can't she take care of my two boys?
Her two boys, Michael smiled. She made him smile as easily as Manny did. Almost.
Carlos and I don't need a new car, Mrs. C, he said.
Oprah would know what to do about all your problems, she said. I believe she is an angel on earth,
but not a Los Angeles angel.
It was a small joke between them, because Mrs. C talked about angels a lot and knew so little about baseball.
No, she said, I don't think your baseball angels are much of a help to us.
Now hush, she said. Oprah was almost over. Michael asked if he could get a drink of water. Mrs. C said there was a pitcher of iced tea she'd just made fresh in the refrigerator, and peanut butter cookies just out of the oven on the counter. He could have a couple if he promised to eat all his supper. Michael said he didn't know what Carlos had left him for supper, and Mrs. C said, forget what Carlos had left. She was going to cook him up some paella, just the way he liked it. Michael left her with Oprah and went into the kitchen, where the baking smells were as familiar to him as everything else in Mrs. C's world. He poured himself a glass of iced tea, orange peels swimming in it as usual, and grabbed two cookies, and when he came back into the living room, she had muted her set for the beginning of the 5 o'clock news. She said,
"Now, what's on your mind, little one? There's always something on your mind when you come here, usually something making you sad."
He told her all about Ellie then, trying to get in all the important parts, all the way to what had just happened down at the field. She raised an eyebrow.
"So this is the girlfriend you were chasing?"
"She's not my girlfriend."
"Sounds like one to me," she said, showing him just the hint of a smile. "Or you wouldn't be so upset about this."
"She's just a girl who happens to be a friend." It's what Manny said about Maria Cuellar all the time. What guys had to say.
"Whatever you say."
She raised an eyebrow at him to let him know she was playing.
"I'm just trying to figure out what I did that was so wrong," Michael said. "You hurt her feelings for no reason, little one. That's what you did wrong. And you know it, because you are too smart not to know it."
"I didn't mean to. It was the words that came out wrong."
"You called her a liar, Michael."
"I said she told a lie she didn't have to tell."
"Obviously, she thought she did."
"She should have trusted me." Mrs. C put out her hand now, a gesture they both knew meant she wanted Michael to help her out of the chair. He did, and she shuffled over in her summer sandals and sat down next to him on the couch, still holding his hand.
"She is the daughter of your hero,"
Mrs. C said.
"But..."
"Hush," Mrs. C said, the same way she had said it at the end of Oprah.
"She is the daughter of the great baseball pitcher, and that is the only way everyone here sees her, no matter where she goes or who she is with. At school, up where you say she lives, in Riverdale, was it? And at Yankee games, too. Only now, she makes two friends, Michael and Manuel, who have no idea who she is, who like her for herself. And she doesn't want to give that up right away, because she likes being liked for herself, likes feeling normal for a change. You, of all people, must be able to understand that."
Michael stared at her face, her dark eyes set in the dark, smooth skin underneath her white hair with all the curls. They were close enough for him to smell the soap smell she gave off, as if she had just come out of one of the bubble baths she always talked about, where she would rest her weary bones at the end of the day. As old as she was, Michael could look at her sometimes and see what she must have looked like when she was young, and, he was sure, beautiful. "Okay," Michael said. "I messed up, big time, the same way I've been messing up all over the place."
"No, you have not," she said. "It's everything that has gotten messed up around you, little one. But it's all going to work out. I promise you."
"Right," Michael said. "Things have been working out so great for me, no reason they should stop now."
"Don't sound so resentful, little one. You know what Grandmama Cora says about people who are resentful in this world?"
Michael knew it by heart. "It's like they take poison and then hope for the other person to die." She squeezed his hand.
"For now, just take care of the things you can take care of. And this Ellie of yours is as good a place to start as any."
"I don't know how."
"Call her and apologize."
"I still don't have her number, and it's not like I can call information and ask for El Grande's house."
"Leave a note for her at the ballpark."
"They'll never give it to her."
"You don't know that until you try."
"She only shows up when her father is pitching," Michael said, "and he doesn't pitch for a few more days, and the Yankees will be out of town by then." He started to feel himself filling up again. It was happening a lot lately, When he started to think about everything and feel like he was Chicken Little in the bedtime story Papi used to read to him about the sky falling. Mrs. C knew.
Come here, little one, she said, pulling him close to her. Let's play our game.
It was the one where he could close his eyes and see the happy endings he wanted. Where everything in his world worked out the way he wanted it to. She would make him go through his wish list, one item at a time.
Just do the baseball parts today, she said.
I don't feel like it today, Mrs. C.
You can do it, she said. I'll even start you off. We found your birth certificate, and all of a sudden, you are running out to the mound at Yankee Stadium, waving to Carlos and me in our front row seats, and we cheer along with the rest of the crowd.
Michael took it from there, holding on tight to Mrs. C, his eyes closed, the smell of her soap covering him like one of her soft blankets. Sometimes, he still felt safe. Chapter 20. Carlos met Uncle Timo for breakfast, just the two of them, at Orem's Diner, three doors up from the McDonald's on 161st Street. The two of them went back and forth about what questions the ACS man might ask, the things Carlos said Uncle Timo absolutely had to know. Like the two of them were studying for a test. Carlos told Michael all about it when he came back to the apartment to change into his work clothes for the Imperial, telling Michael at the same time that he would be back at 1 o'clock when Mr. Gibbs was supposed to show up. He'd arranged it with his boss to get an hour off for lunch, just for today.
You think Uncle Timo knows enough about us to get by now? Michael said.
Fingers crossed, Carlos said. But I have to tell you, with that guy, he's serious 1 minute and then acting like a total goofball the next.
Carlos tapped the side of his head.
He's a little crazy up here, this one.
We're the crazy ones, Michael said. To think we could pull something like this off with somebody as smart as Mr. Gibbs.
You mean somebody who probably has kids trying to scam him all the time?
He's gonna see right through this, Michael said.
We still have to try, Miguel. We can't be looking over our shoulder for him every day from now until my 18th birthday. Once he's out of the way, we can try to get your birth certificate before it's too late for it to do us any good.
Michael said, You know what Yogi Berra used to say, right?
Even I know Yogi used to say a lot of things, Carlos said.
One of his best, Michael said, was when he said, It sure gets late early around here. Uncle Timo was supposed to arrive at the apartment at 12:30, a half hour before Mr. Gibbs. Manny, who had come over to spend the morning with Michael, promised his uncle would be on time.
He knows how important this is, Manny said.
You sure about that?
Would it help if I told you to relax again?
No, Michael said. At 12:45, Uncle Timo still wasn't there. Manny used the phone in the kitchen to try his cell. No answer.
You're probably on your way, Manny said into the receiver, but please call when you get this.
Michael went over and sat on the windowsill, looking one way and then the other, hoping he would see Uncle Timo or Carlos walking up the street before Mr. Gibbs. All he saw was a street cleaning truck and some little girls from across the street playing foursquare on a chalk outline on the sidewalk.
What time is it now? He said to Manny. 5 minutes since the last time you asked me, Manny said.
At 1 o'clock on the nose, Carlos called, sounding pretty frantic, shouting over all the shouting Michael could hear in the background, to say that a pipe had burst at the Imperial, flooding the place, and that there was no way he could leave. They'd had to close the store and were trying to save as much of the food as possible.
I'm so sorry, Miguel, Carlos said, but I'm afraid you're on your own today.
I'm just afraid, Michael said, and hung up. As soon as he went back to his perch on the windowsill, he saw Mr. Gibbs come around the corner of 158th Street. No Carlos, no Uncle Timo.
He's here, Michael said to Manny. Great.
Michael said, What do we tell him when he asks where my father is?
Daddy's out running an errand, and he'll be right back, Manny said.
There was a knock on the door, As Michael went to answer it, Manny said,
"One more thing."
"We have enough things," Manny said.
"I think it would help if you didn't look like you just broke a window."
Michael gave him a face and opened the door. Mr. Gibbs was wearing a faded short-sleeved shirt with a tiny crocodile on the front hanging out over his pants, and the same beat-up sneakers he'd been wearing the other times Michael had seen him. "My dad will be back any second," Michael said, not even bothering to say hello. "He had to run an errand." He didn't move, just stood there with his hand on the doorknob. Mr. Gibbs didn't move. Finally, Mr. Gibbs said,
"Do you mind if I come in and wait inside?"
"Sorry," Michael said, making a sweeping gesture with his hand like he was showing him in. "Did you ever meet my friend Manny?"
"The catcher," Mr. Gibbs said.
Manny smiled, obviously pleased that Mr. Gibbs had recognized him. At least somebody was in a good mood. Mr. Gibbs said to Michael,
"Is Carlos coming?"
Michael explained what was happening at the Imperial. Mr. Gibbs said he understood and sat down. Michael, trying to remember his manners, asked if he wanted something to drink. Mr. Gibbs said he was fine for now. Then nobody said anything for what seemed like an hour to Michael until Mr. Gibbs said,
"It must be great having your dad home."
"I just wish he could stay longer," Michael said.
"When does he have to go back?"
"Today or tomorrow. He's not sure."
"Would Uncle Timo say that? Shoot."
"He probably wishes you were pitching tonight."
"Not as much as I do," Michael said.
"Correction," Manny said. "Not as much as we do."
"On that subject," Mr. Gibbs said, "if there's anything I can do..."
Michael said, "Carlos keeps calling people, in Havana, I mean, but the phone calls are expensive, and always it seems that the person he's talking to isn't the person he needs to be talking to."
"I hate to say it," Mr. Gibbs said, "but in that sense, Castro's government sounds a lot like ours."
"Sometimes I think we need a miracle," Michael said.
The door opened then, and Uncle Timo walked in. Only, he wasn't Uncle Timo. At least not today. Michael could see it, without his having said a word. He knew he was staring, but he couldn't help himself. Uncle Timo had turned himself into Papi.
Chapter 21.
Even Manny was speechless for a change. Uncle Timo was wearing Papi's favorite old khaki slacks, the ones Carlos had sent home with Manny the night before, and the kind of black t-shirt their father had always seemed to be wearing when he wasn't driving. Papi's old pocket watch, the one that had belonged to their grandfather, was attached to a thick chain hanging from Uncle Timo's belt. But it wasn't just the clothes. In just one day, Uncle Timo's beard looked as heavy as Papi's had been the day he died, and he had shaved his head into the dark crew cut Papi always wore in the summer. Even from where he stood across the room, Michael could see the tattoo on Timo Morales' right forearm of a tocorroco, the national bird of Cuba, the feathers almost as big as the bird itself. Just like Papi's tattoo, the one he used to joke was better than anything any NBA player had on his arm or his leg, or even his neck. Michael was wondering if it was real as Uncle Timo walked toward him with his arms stretched wide the way Papi always did when he came through the door, hugged him close, kissed the side of his face, Michael feeling a familiar scratch of beard that actually made him shiver. "I feel like I'm with a ghost," he thought.
"El ratoncito Miguel," he said.
It meant Mike the Little Mouse. Father was the best Michael could do. He even sounds like him, Michael thought, the words coming out in a husky voice like the low growl of a dog. The accent was perfect. Uncle Timo pulled back now, winking at Michael as he did, saying,
"Silencio, no hay que gritas, no se vaya a despertar."
Carlos must have given him Cuban expressions to use, whether they made sense or not. If Mr. Gibbs did speak Cuban somehow, he was probably wondering why Michael's father was telling him not to scream and wake up the cat. Uncle Timo turned toward Mr. Gibbs then, right hand extended toward him, saying,
"How do you do, sir? I am Victor Arroyo, and I'm here to be thanking you so much for taking an interest in my ratoncito."
Papi's English, Michael thought, was better. Had been better. But Mr. Gibbs didn't know that. The two men shook hands. As they did, Mr. Gibbs said, "I speak a little Spanish, but not enough to know what that means."
"From the time he was born and made these little squeaks in his crib, Michael has been my little mouse," Uncle Timo said.
"Even as I watched him grow up and start to throw a baseball like a young Sandy Koufax."
He pointed a finger now at the ACS man, said,
"You are the right age to have seen the great Koufax. Am I correct, sir?"
"You got me," Mr. Gibbs said. "He was my favorite pitcher of all time. I grew up in Brooklyn, but I was one of the kids who kept rooting for the Dodgers after they left for Los Angeles."
"The way we Cubanos always rooted for our baseball heroes after they started leaving us for America."
The two of them standing here and chatting like old friends after knowing each other for, what, 2 whole minutes?
"Please, have a seat, Mr. Gibbs," Uncle Timo said, gesturing toward the couch. "I will take my favorite chair, the one I have not gotten to sit in too much as of lately, and which my son say should be condemned."
He put a little extra accent into the last word, making it come out condemned. Mr. Gibbs took a seat on the couch. Uncle Timo gave Michael another quick wink, as if the two of them were sharing a private joke.
"And what about you two? Would you care to sit down and join us, Miguelito?"
Another Papi expression.
"Or are the two of you just going to stand there like statues in a church?"
"I'm fine," Michael said.
"I'm good,"
Manny said. Uncle Timo got right to it with Mr. Gibbs.
"I am so sorry," he said, "for somehow making you worry that I had abandoned my two boys."
"I just feel that in my job," Mr. Gibbs said, "it's better to be safe than sorry. And believe me, the last thing we want to do at the ACS is put two more boys in the care of the city."
"Of course."
"There was a time," Mr. Gibbs said, "when we had over 50,000 children in the system. But over the past several years, that number has dropped to under 20,000.
Uncle Timo sighed.
"It is still a big enough crowd to fill the Madison Square Garden."
"It's why I'd rather be too nosy than not nosy enough," Mr. Gibbs said. "If I even get a whiff that two young kids may be living without a parent, no matter how well they think they're doing, I wouldn't be doing my job if I didn't check it out." Uncle Timo's eyes locked on Michael's, the smallest of smiles on his face as he said,
"We are so grateful that an official person like yourself took such an interest in our family. Even if it has not been so much of a family lately."
He nodded as if he'd convinced himself of something, then said,
"This is how we hoped America would work. People caring for other people in such a way as this."
Even Michael thought he was starting to spread it on a little thick, but he could see there was no stopping him now.
"Would anybody like some lemonade?" Michael said. "Manny and I were just going to make some when Mr. Gibbs showed up, weren't we?"
Manny said,
"Right, a lemonade. Boy, I'm thirsty enough to drink a whole pitcher."
They walked through the kitchen doors as they heard Mr. Gibbs say,
"So, Mr. Arroyo, call me Victor, please."
So, Victor,
Mr. Gibbs said,
"tell me about your brother."
Michael and Manny were standing just inside the kitchen door. Manny said,
"This is so on!"
Michael pinched Manny's arm with one hand, put a finger to his lips with the other.
"Ouch!"
"Shh!" Manny said,
I was just saying.
You're always just saying,
Michael whispered.
I just would appreciate it if you didn't say anything right now.
Manny couldn't help himself.
All I was trying to say...
Manny, Michael said, just this one time, I don't want you to do play-by-play on your life.
They both listened at the door to Uncle Timo, who Michael thought was a clown when he met him, like one of the clowns that used to make him laugh at the famous Havana circus, El Guinol Nacional. Now he was telling Mr. Gibbs a story that even Michael found himself believing, about an uncle of Michael's that did not exist, about his brother's terrible blood sickness that was so far gone, but somehow could not kill him, about the woman his brother Santos had lived with for years in a place called Homestead, Florida. Where was that? Michael wondered to himself. A sweet, beautiful woman that Santos had hoped to marry once, before he took ill. He said that her name was Julia, then actually gave Mr. Gibbs her phone number, in case he ever again had concerns about Carlos and Michael and needed to contact him immediately. Michael poked Manny.
Who is Julia?
Will you please stop hitting me?
Is she real?
Oh, now I can talk?
Michael just stared at him, the way he did in baseball when Manny would come walking out for a chat and Michael would stare him back behind the plate.
Julia is the name of the old girlfriend Uncle Timo told us about,
Manny said.
The one from the dinner theater down there.
In the living room, Uncle Timo was saying,
I make a promise to my brother that I will be there for him until the end.
I understand, Mr. Gibbs said.
When I am down there, I am constantly on the phone, trying to find someone in Havana who can find a copy of Michael's birth certificate, which somehow has disappeared.
There was a pause, and then Uncle Timo said,
Maybe because we disappeared on the boat that night.
It's stupid that Michael even has to be put through this, if you want my opinion, Mr. Gibbs said. Next to Michael, Manny said,
Tell me about it.
Michael made a motion like he was going to pinch him again.
Don't come any closer,
Manny said. He cracked the door open just slightly. Uncle Timo was saying to Mr. Gibbs,
I am the big stupid for making sure I did not have it in my possession before we said goodbye to Cuba forever and for good.
I told Michael before you got here, and now I'll tell you, Mr. Gibbs said. If there's anything I can do, let me know.
Maybe if an official person from here called an official person there.
I can't make any promises, Mr. Gibbs said, but I'll sure give it a shot. Uncle Timo raised his voice now and said,
I thought you two knuckleballs said you had the lemonade made already.
Coming, Poppy,
Manny said.
Poppy?
Michael said.
I want to get into the act.
Wow, Michael said. That doesn't sound anything like you. Michael carried the pitcher they had put in the refrigerator. Manny brought four glasses on the kind of plastic tray you got for your food at McDonald's. Uncle Timo poured, like it was some kind of party, and he was pouring wine or champagne for his guests. Then he raised his own glass.
To my Miguelito, he said. May the next time we are all together be on the day when he pitches himself and his proud puppy to the Little League World Series in Williamsport, Pennsylvania.
They all clicked glasses and drank lemonade. Uncle Timo drank his in loud gulps, then made a big show of wiping his mustache with the back of his hand, just the way Poppy used to. Then, as if overcome by the emotion of this great moment, he spread his arms wide again, motioning Michael to come into them.
My son, he said.
He put his arms around Michael and hugged him even tighter than he had when he came in. And then, in a whispery voice, just barely loud enough for Michael Arroyo to hear, he said,
Top that, dude.
Chapter 22. In his heart, Michael knew he wasn't going to play any more baseball this season. But it was all right. Really, it was. Even if this was his one and only chance to make it to the Little League World Series. Even if it turned out he missed out on that, he told himself he would get over it, as long as he and Carlos got to stay together. And, Michael had to admit, he felt a lot better about their chances now that Uncle Timo had put on such a good show for Mr. Gibbs. So he kept telling himself to feel good about that, mostly because he needed to feel good about something today, the first day of the playoffs for the Clippers. After all the surprises in his life lately, just about every single one of them bad, Uncle Timo turning himself into Papi the way he had, that was most definitely a good thing. Maybe that was the way you should go through life, if you really thought about it. Maybe, if you didn't expect good things to happen to you, well, when something did, it would seem much bigger and better than it actually was. A few weeks ago, the only victory that would have mattered today would have been the Clippers over the Rosedale Park Robins at McCombs. Not anymore. The biggest win of the day was Uncle Timo. By a lot. Everything after this was going to be the cherry on top of the ice cream sundae that Manny was always talking about. In Manny's view of the world, there was always another sundae coming along that needed another cherry. Just because Manny believed every single day was going to be the best of his whole life. Michael tried to remember the last time he had felt that way about stuff. But he couldn't. The Rosedale Park Robins were really good, at least when they had all their players. The problem for them was they had played most of the season without their best player, Corey Allen, their Michael Arroyo, as Manny referred to him. Corey Allen had managed to slice open the bottom of his foot playing soccer barefoot just a couple of days into the District 22 season. He'd had to get 20 stitches, or so Manny had heard from a friend of his who played on the Robins, and hadn't returned to his team until there were 2 weeks to go in the regular season, pitching well enough to get them the last slot in the playoffs. If he'd been healthy, Anthony Fierro was saying after infield practice at McCombs, they'd have been good enough to fight us for the number one seed. Manny, at that moment, was trying to stuff a world's record amount of bubblegum into his mouth, his right cheek already looking as if he had a baseball in there.
Yeah, he said, and if my mom had wheels, she'd be a bicycle.
I was just saying, Anthony said. Mr. Minaya said,
the great football coach, Bill Parcells, has a saying.
Michael looked at Manny, who rolled his eyes, just because for about the 1,000th time, Mr. Minaya had a saying that applied to whatever they happened to be talking about. Michael figured that the great Bill Parcells probably ran out of sayings eventually, but Mr. M never did. Mr. M said,
Coach Parcells likes to say that in sports, you are what your record says you are.
I liked our record a lot better when we had Michael.
Manny said,
we will win tonight and get young Mr. Arroyo back somehow before we play again, Mr. M said.
In your dreams, Michael thought, and mine.
Win one for Michael, Manny said.
Win one for Mike, Anthony said.
Then all the Clippers were gathered around Michael and chanting, Mike, 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 almost making him feel like a real part of the team. Right before the start of the game, Mr. M came over to where Michael was sitting, at the end of the bench, near the big duffel bag filled with their practice balls.
I want you to coach third base tonight, Mr. M said.
Michael put a hand to his ear, as if he hadn't heard him correctly.
Excuse me?
I want you to coach third.
No way!
Mr. M grinned.
Way, he said,
sounding like one of the kids on the team.
Mr. M, he said, you always coach third, every single game. And this isn't every single game, it's a playoff game.
I know.
Corey Allen is pitching,
Michael said,
which means every run is going to count.
Yes, I am aware of that,
Mr. M said. Michael looked around to make sure nobody else could hear.
Please don't make me.
You should want to coach third,
Mr. M said.
Why is that?
Michael said.
Because coaching third is as close as you can get to the action without actually playing,
Mr. M said.
And in my opinion, getting you as close to the action as possible gives us our best possible chance to win the game.
Michael could see there was no way he was going to change his mind. Once Mr. M dug in, he dug in.
I hope you're right, Michael said.
I am.
He was wrong. In the bottom of the fifth, with Anthony Fierro, in Manny's words, pitching his lungs off, the game was still scoreless. Kel was on first, nobody out. Manny put a great swing on a Corey Allen fastball and drilled it up the alley in left center, between the center fielder and the left fielder. It looked as if the ball was going to roll all the way to the wall, until it didn't. The center fielder came over and cut the ball off. By then, Michael was sure that the ball was deep enough to score Kel whether it got cut off or not. So he was sending Kel all the way from the time he rounded second, waving his arms like he was a windmill, even as the center fielder made a perfect cut-off throw to Corey Allen himself, standing near second base. Michael sent Kel home even though he could have held him at third, and the Clippers would have had runners on second and third, still with nobody out. Corey Allen caught the ball and turned and threw home all in one motion. Threw home as if he were throwing one of his fastballs. Threw a perfect strike to the Robins catcher, who put the tag on Kel and kept the game at 0-0. Manny didn't take third on the throw to the plate. He hesitated as he watched the play at the plate. Then must have decided that he didn't want to run himself into a double play, run the Clippers right out of the inning. So he only got to third when Chris Norris grounded out to the Robins second baseman, the kid making a terrific sliding stop to keep the ball from going into right field, then getting Norris by a step at first. Then Anthony Fierro struck out to end the inning. Michael thought,
even with my bonehead play, Manny should have been on third. With one out, this late in the game, the Robins would have had to bring the infield in for a possible play at the plate on a ground ball. And Chris Norris's ball would have gone past the second baseman before he even moved on it, and Manny could have walked home.
Stop it, you jerk.
Mr. M always said, never assume how things could have played out in baseball, or how an inning could have played itself out.
The truth was that Manny should have been on second and Kel on third with nobody out. And from there, it would have been practically impossible for the Clippers not to be ahead 1-0. Only, they weren't ahead. They were still tied.
Because of me,
Michael thought.
What had he been thinking?
He had always taken pride in knowing the right play at any given moment in the game. Bobby had schooled him on fundamentals from the first time he had played organized baseball in Havana, back when he was 7. When he was in the outfield, he always hit the right cutoff man. When he was pitching, he backed up first base on even the most routine plays in the infield. He never took a chance on the bases, never, if he wasn't sure he could take an extra base. Even as close as the backstop behind home plate was at most of the fields where they played, Manny knew Michael would always have his back on plays at the plate. 3 or 4 times this season, there had been a bad relay throw that skipped past Manny, but Michael had been there to scoop the ball up and throw out somebody on the other team, being foolish enough to take an extra base on him. Now he had been responsible for the bonehead play of the year. The District 22 playoffs were double elimination, so the season wasn't over if the Clippers lost to the Robins. Just as good as over, because as soon as you lost a game in the playoffs, you went into the loser's bracket.
For losers like me,
Michael thought, as he walked slowly behind the screen to get back to the bench, and had to play another losing team the next day just to keep playing. Extra games meant extra pitchers, and the Clippers, without Michael, didn't have enough pitching to begin with. Forget about making it to Williamsport. If they lost tonight, they'd be lucky to make it to the end of the stinking week.
Forget it,
Manny said after Michael had taken what felt like a 5-mile walk back to the bench and sat down with him.
We'll get him next inning.
Michael pulled his cap down as tight as he could over his eyes. What makes you think so?
Because we are not losing to the Robins. That's what makes me think so,
Manny said, using Manny logic. Maybe we just did. Michael tried to pull the cap down even lower over his eyes, like he wanted to use it as a mask.
I am such a loser.
Hey,
Manny said. He reached over and tried to pull Michael's cap off his eyes and pulled it right off his head instead.
Look at me,
Manny said in a mean voice Michael almost didn't recognize. Michael turned around, staring at his cap in Manny's hand like he was the magician who came to school once a year and had just pulled the rabbit out of the hat. Manny said,
If you're gonna talk like a loser, go sit somewhere else, because I don't want to listen to you anymore.
Maybe there was another time when his best friend had talked to him like this, but Michael sure couldn't remember it.
All I meant was... All you meant was that you're feeling sorry for yourself, and you want to tell me all about it,
Manny said.
I'm just telling you to stop, okay? Because it's not doing us any good, okay?
Okay.
You want to make yourself useful?
Manny said.
Figure out something that will help us win the game.
He handed Michael back his cap.
Okay?
Okay already,
Michael said. Manny finished putting his catcher's equipment back on while Mr. M warmed up Anthony. It seemed like about 5 minutes later, the Robins had the bases loaded with two outs. Mr. M asked Michael, who'd been charting Anthony's pitches, how many he had thrown.
60 on the nose, Michael said.
Well, then he's done, isn't he?
Coach, Michael said.
Corey Allen's up. You know he's their best hitter on top of being their best pitcher. Anthony only gave him a single first time up, and then he got him to fly to Teddy. He's still our best chance, even if he is right up against the pitch limit.
Nobody pitches past 60, Michael, not even you.
60 for Mr. M, who always said he was never going to put a 12-year-old pitcher's arm in jeopardy, was as much a magic number for him as 80, as in miles per hour, was for Michael and Manny.
Well, who are you going to bring in?
Michael said. Mr. M leaned back, closed his eyes for a second, then said,
Kel, maybe after seeing Anthony throw nothing but fastballs all game, Kel can fool Corey with a couple of those wiffle balls he throws up there.
Mr. M sat up straight, clapped his hands together one time, as if that settled it.
Kel it is. For one batter, if he gets out of it, I'll go with Norse in extra innings.
Mr. M called time, walked out to the mound, called all the infielders in when he got there, put his arm around Anthony's shoulder, took the ball from him. Then Michael saw Mr. M talking to Kel. Saw Kel's eyes get wide as he looked at Corey Allen in the on-deck circle. Saw Kel turn back to Mr. M and mouth the words,
No way.
Mr. M said something else. Kel said something back. Then suddenly Kel laughed. Mr. M put Anthony at third, moved Chris Norse to short, walked back to the bench as Kel began taking his warm-ups. Michael asked what had been so funny that it got a laugh out of Kel.
Manny.
What did he say?
Mr. M laughed now.
Well, he didn't actually say anything.
Michael knew.
I asked if anybody had anything they wanted to add, and Manny made his, famous whoopee cushion noise. The one he seems to be able to produce at will.
Michael said, his signature move. Then he and Mr. M both watched, neither one of them saying anything, as Kel, throwing pitches that really did seem to float up to home plate like buds blowing in the wind, finally got Corey Allen to take a huge swing at a 2-2 pitch and pop the ball to Norse for the third out. Inning over. Game still 0-0. Michael nudged Mr. M, and stuck out his palm so Mr. M could give him a low five.
Righteous pitching move, he said.
Mr. M said,
See, that's the thing, Michael. They are all good moves in baseball when they work.
Chapter 23 Maria Cuellar walked to start the bottom of the sixth inning for the Clippers. Corey Allen was still in there pitching for the Robins, but this was it for him. Even if the game kept going, six innings being all you could pitch in one game in the playoffs. If you did pitch six, you had to take one game and one day off before you could pitch again. The Robins coach, a loud little guy in a Yankees cap, was yelling as much now, Michael noticed, as he had when the game started, moving all his fielders around, infielders and outfielders both, as soon as Maria got down to first base. Manny always joked that he wished you could use the kind of electric fence that people use for their dogs at Little League fields, so you could zap coaches if they went near the field for anything except making a pitching change.
The worst thing that could happen now was extra innings. But nobody on the Clips bench, all of them with their caps turned sideways, rally cap time, was thinking about extra innings now that Maria was on base. They were thinking about ending the sucker right now. Nate Collins, the Clippers' left fielder, bunted Maria to second. One out. Tommy Growney, the right fielder, grounded to second, Maria taking third on the play. Two outs. Their last shot at Corey Allen. Bobby Cameron, the weakest hitter they had at the plate. Their third baseman moved in a little. When he did, Maria said to Michael,
Any strategy here I ought to know about?
Soon, he said.
How soon?
Right before you score the winning run.
With Bobby hitting?
With Bobby hitting, Michael said.
Bobby was only in center tonight because the regular center fielder, Zach Frazier, was sick with some kind of summer flu. Bobby Cameron had been a decent player during the regular season, playing for the Willis Avenue Mets, but he'd stopped hitting almost as soon as All-Star started, and now was completely clueless at the plate. He'd been up twice against Corey Allen and struck out both times on three pitches, both times making strike three easy, swinging at pitches over his head, as if he just wanted to get the at-bat over with and get back to the bench. Now Michael could see, just by the look on Bobby Cameron's face when he looked down toward third for a sign, wanting to know if he should take a strike, that he wanted to be just about any place on the planet Earth except facing Corey Allen with what might be the winning run on third. Michael knew the look, because he saw it from guys having to face him all the time. Back when he was a pitcher, not a third base coach.
Figure out a way to win us this game, Manny had said.
Mr. M said, Hey,